Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. We talk on Mondays about the great things going on at the University of Arizona. It's like a little small city or even a state. There's so much going on in so many different departments and research and education and student learning and commitment to the community. One of the unique things that we have at the University of Arizona in the College of Agricultural Life and Environmental Sciences through the Cooperative Extension Service is an interesting collection of things. And the curator of that, the collections manager, is Jean Hall. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning.
And you collect some interesting things down there. You're a bug collector, basically, or an insect collector, right?
Well,
manager of that process.
Yeah, manager of the collection. I'm the manager of the collection. The curator is Dr. Wendy Moore.
Right.
And so I manage the day-to-day operations of the collection.
Right. So there's a picture of you with a bunch of butterflies, and you're holding them in a tray in your hand, and there must be 300 butterflies in the case that you're holding. And so your job is to make sure that they're all cataloged and put in the right place and labeled and know what they all are, what the scientists have picked up or the collectors have picked up, and you are the one that's in charge of making sure they're stored properly, right?
Exactly. I manage the layout, maintain the collection, and also we have a good staff of students and volunteers that help out too.
Yeah. Interesting that volunteers, do they bug you at all?
No, they don't bug me, but they're all very enthusiastic,
and they take
their job very seriously, but they all love insects.
Right. How'd you get the job? How did you get to the collection, being the collections manager at the Cooperative Extension with insects? How'd you get to that? What fascinated you about that job to get that job?
Well, it's actually a little bit of a long story. I did some research in that collection back in the 1980s, and then I eventually got my graduate degree here at the University of Arizona Department of Entomology, and went on to manage museum collections elsewhere at University of Nebraska State Museum in Lincoln, and then University of Colorado Museum of Natural History in Boulder. Mm-hmm. And then about the time I wanted to come back to Tucson, the position was opening up here at the insect collection, and it was kind of where I wanted to eventually end up with my last part of my career. And it just worked out that way and got the greatest job in the world.
Yeah. So realistically, you are taking insects that have been maybe there from 40 years ago or even longer maybe, but new ones that are coming in, and your job is to sort them and put them in the right place so that when they're called on for display or research or whatever, they know where they are, and you're the one that's kind of like, you're almost like a librarian of insects, correct?
Yeah, you can sort of look at it as a library of biodiversity for the region.
Mm-hmm.
And we represent all groups of insects for the region. We're the largest collection in the world of Arizona and northern Sonoran Desert insects. We have a little over 2 million specimens.
Wow.
And it continues to grow every year because we act as a repository for vouchers for research for the university, but also other researchers too.
Right. We were laughing earlier that Sir Ken Robinson said that if all the insects in the world disappeared, human beings would last maybe a couple of decades. If all the human beings in the world disappear, insects would go on to infinity, and they would do just fine here. There's millions of them, millions of different kinds of insects that. You have 2 million in your place. You could have. It's amazing how many insects there are in the world.
Yeah, we're such a great area of diversity here in southeastern Arizona, especially, and we probably have a little over 30,000 some odd species of insects in the collection, and probably 20,000 of those or more are to the region. But we're also discovering new species every year and adding more to the collection.
Yeah, there's some estimates say, I don't even know how to write the word quintillion, but that there are 10 quintillion. That's 10 followed by 18 zeros. That's how many estimated insects there are on the earth. And you think about that, we got a couple billion humans, but we've got 10 quintillion insects on the earth, and it's amazing. You don't have to catalog that many, but
no, actually our strengths are that we're a regional collection, so we don't take like large collections like say from Brazil or from other areas. We try to stay within our region and adjacent areas, and that's why we do so well with what we have.
Yeah. Oh, in your career there at the U of A, are there any interesting insects? I mean, there's obviously with that many, there's going to be a couple that just stand out. But what's the most interesting, you know, a rainbow caterpillar or a scorpion or whatever? What would be an interesting insect that just is kind of maybe a butterfly or something that's unique to the Southwest that is something that comes to mind?
Well, you know, they all have their own
right
uniqueness about them and such. And one of the groups that we're actually focused on right now are the native bees.
Mm.
And we're doing projects to digitize the collection, to catalog the native bees in the region, because Arizona has the largest diversity of native bees in probably any place else in the world except for maybe Israel.
Wow.
And so one of the things we're trying to do right now is document the species diversity in our area. And we're learning new things all the time. And we also, curator Wendy Moore and others have started a thing called the Tucson Bee Collaborative also, and that's to educate people about native bee diversity in the region.
Interesting, interesting. Well, we're talking with Gene Hall. He's the collections manager in the College of Agricultural Life and Environmental Sciences, formerly CALS, now CALES, at the University of Arizona Cooperative Extension, the University of Arizona Insect Collection, which houses a bunch of thousands of insects that are native to the Southwest and so forth. That's pretty amazing. How do you go about doing that? How do you catalog them? How do you know where to put them?
Well, the collection is arranged by groups of insects. So one section are the beetles, one section are the butterflies and moths. And so whenever specimens come in, they eventually end up in the right section for their groups, for their families.
Right.
And, you know, we have everything's basically laid out in a scheme that makes it easy to track them down if we have to find a particular specimen or species.
Are they all in those kind of drawers like the butterflies are, where you can look mm-hmm. at them and see them kind of a glass top so you can see down into them?
Yeah. Yeah. They're in drawers within cabinets. And we continue to expand all the time. Last year, we just had our second expansion in 2 years. And so it's quite an experience.
Yeah, I bet. And when we come back from the break, we'll talk about cicadas and the article that appeared in UA News. We're talking with Gene Hall. He's the collection manager of the University of Arizona Insect Collection at the University of Arizona out of CALES. And when we come back after the break, we'll talk about those noisy little critters called cicadas that kind of echo in the and welcome in summer to the Southwest and all over the South. Their little violins playing nightly when the sun goes down. You hear those cicadas quite loudly. So you're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's only live local news and talk. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. I am your host. Our guest this segment is Gene Hall. He is the collections manager at the CALES Cooperative Extension, University of Arizona Insect Collection, and he helps catalog and store and make available to researchers thousands of different species of insects that can come out when they need to and be looked at and tested and researched and whatever needs to happen with them. So his job is to make sure they're in the right place at the right time and that they're stored properly. So recently the UA News ran a little article called What's the Buzz? Kind of recirculated that from a previous article, but 10 things that you did not know about cicada. So tell us a little bit about what a cicada is for those people that don't know. They've heard them. They may not know what they are though, right?
Right. Yeah, so they're really starting to pop up right now here around Tucson and southeastern Arizona. They're an insect. They belong to the group Hemiptera. These are plant-feeding insects, and they have piercing, sucking mouth parts that allow them to feed from the fluids and juices from the plant. They're completely harmless, and they have what's known as an incomplete metamorphosis. And so they hatch from an egg, they have nymphal stages, and then they emerge as an adult after that.
Right. And what I said was that everyone knows them because they are the interesting insect that when you go out on a summer evening and they've come out of their ground habitat for however long, they're the ones that sound like the little tiny violins out playing their music in the middle of the night to try to, I guess, attract other people, other cicadas to them, right?
Yeah. So each species has its own sound, its own call. And so, and right now, I start hearing them usually late morning right now, and you can hear them go into all the early part of the evening and all day long.
Yeah, very amazing. So a couple of things out of the article, 10 things that you did not know about cicadas. Here's one that I thought was interesting. Cicadas are essentially tiny violins with wings, and that's an interesting little perspective of how to say what a cicada is. So they actually use their legs and so forth to make that noise?
No, actually, they have a structure on the underside. The males do. So the males do the call, and they have a structure on the underside called the tympanum. And what they do is they use that structure to make the sound, and then the hollowed cavities, parts of the body, most likely the abdomen, help amplify that sound.
Mm-hmm. And they're a little menacing when you see them. Well, you don't see them often because they're good hiders. But when you do see them, they're a little bit menacing. They've got the big wings, and they've got those big red beady eyes, and they're fairly large, maybe about the size of a quarter or a 50-cent piece, depending on what breed they are. So when you see them, if you get a chance to see them, they look a little, but they're harmless, right?
Oh, they're completely harmless. And one thing, I just want to correct myself on something I just said. It's a structure called the timbal that the male has that creates a sound.
Right.
And the tympanum is what they use for hearing the sound.
Got it.
But yeah, they're completely harmless. They're, like I said, they don't bite, they don't sting, and, you know, they provide a great nutritious protein meal for other organisms if they can catch them, because they're very difficult to try to catch.
Right. So you said that the Southwest is home to one of the highest insect diversity in the nation, if not the world. And cicadas are no exception, although there's only a few in the Southwest, but across the nation, there's a lot of different kinds of cicadas, right? So they're varied just like the other kinds of insects.
Yeah. We have here in Arizona, I think, close to 50 species throughout the whole state. Mm-hmm. And then there's different species that have different life cycles. It could be any time from 3 to 4 to 5 years underground, and then as opposed to the ones back east, the periodical cicadas that are 17 year and 13 years.
Yeah. And how does that, I mean, in the Southwest here in Arizona and Tucson and so forth, they come out about every 3 years. And so it's cyclical. So some summers there'll be more than maybe the summer before. And it appears to be louder. But that's because of that staying underground for a lengthy period of time, right?
Yeah, so we have annuals, emergences here, but sometimes they come out later than usual, maybe earlier than usual. Sometimes the numbers aren't that loud. And I think a lot of that has to do with environmental conditions too, during their developmental stage underground.
Right. And how far underground are they? Not very far, I would imagine. Huh?
Not very far, and especially with as hard as the ground gets here.
Right, the caliche, as we call it.
So whenever you have the nymphal stage underground feeding on roots, it eventually, at a stage in its life, keys into the ground temperature and what's going on with the plants, and then that's when they crawl out of the ground and they find a place to crawl up onto. This usually happens in the evening. And then the adult emerges from the last nymphal stage. And then overnight, the exoskeleton hardens up. And they do this at night as a way of avoiding predators. So things that would normally feed on them aren't out at nighttime.
Right. Do you have all 50 species in the collection, or do you have as many as you can get, obviously, because they're hard to find, right?
Yeah.
They're good. They like to hide from people and from predators, so they like to hide. So.
Yeah, I think we have around 40 species of Arizona cicadas in our collection, and they range in all shapes and sizes and colors. You know, one reason why they're hard to find is because they generally hang out at the hottest part of the day. Mm-hmm. So they have built in their own evaporative cooling system, and that allows them to be out when it's 110, 105. And that's one way of also avoiding predation, because a lot of things that would normally feed on them can't handle being out during those high temperatures.
Right. So. And in the article, it was talking about how when they make the sound, too, that the way that they make it, it's hard to pinpoint where it's coming from. And so that's also probably a predatory thing. If they make the noise and then you can't really tell what direction it's coming from, especially if there's multiple ones in the same area.
Yeah, and they're also really good at stopping with their sound, with their call, if right. you get too close to them. And I've watched them before. They're really good at moving around on the branch of a tree. Right. So when they see you coming, they'll move around so you can't see them.
That's amazing. Can the public view any of these insects? Do you ever have displays, or can they ever come down and see butterflies or cicadas or the insects that you have, or are there showings of them at any point?
Well, so basically what we are, we're a museum research collection, so we don't have like public displays and exhibits. But certain times of the year, like doing either the book festival whatever, we'll set up tours for people. And we generally, whatever we're working with, make sure that gets announced. And that's how we can do it.
And so if people checked into the website, which is on the Kales website under etymology, and look at the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences is Kales, and then look under the etymology, they would be able, from time to time, be able to catch some of that and know when you're going to be out with some samples and so forth.
Yeah, and they can always also email me. We have a website for the University of Arizona Insect Collection, mm-hmm. and I'm listed there on the staff page, and they can email me if they have questions about wanting to know about future tours or whatever.
Right, right. Or if they want to identify what they found,
yes.
and don't know what it is or whatever, they might want to contact you guys and have you guys see the sample and see if it's something that you have, or it could be, who knows, maybe you've discovered something new that there's so many of them that maybe there's something that you haven't seen before.
Yeah, so another part of my job is I oversee the insect diagnostics clinic through the Cooperative Extension Program, and that's to provide insect identifications to, you know, the residents of Arizona and beyond. So people can email me photographs of insects that they find, and I work with identifications and also samples they submit. So it's something we offer as part of the Cooperative Extension Program, since we're the land-grant university for the state.
And that's important, being a land-grant university. That's one of the Cooperative Extension is a huge part of that, because land-grant obviously is about the land, and it's as a Research One institution and being the land-grant institution in the state. That puts the University of Arizona in a unique position, and so research is a number one, and we're a Research One institution, which means that research is really important. And so you facilitate getting the insects to the right researchers for the right reasons at the right time, and they bring them to you, but they also pull them out and take a look at them and see what they can find, right?
Yeah, we have researchers visiting the collection locally, nationally, worldwide, and so we're a great resource for that. And also, like I said, with the Insect Diagnostics Clinic, I provide identifications for everything from homeowners to forensics to medical entomology, veterinary entomology, agriculture. So it's just part of the service we provide.
Yeah, I'm not sure a tarantula is an insect, but in my house over the last 35 years, we have had insects that have come in, and you know, you kind of want to know what they are, and you know, is this insect something we should be concerned about, or is it something that is just a friendly that's making its way through on its way to its next location? And it's good to know that kind of information, so you don't want to in their domain on Earth just because you don't know what they are. Yeah,
no, you know, and it, you know, insect tarantulas or arachnids, but we do other non-insect arthropods, and
right.
so tarantulas, you know, other spiders, scorpions, and such. And what I do is I provide information on the insect or the arachnid or whatever it is, and then it's up to people to kind of make informed decisions on how they want to deal with that. And they're generally very happy just to know something about its life history and its biology.
Yeah. A very interesting career path for you, a very interesting job that you have of curating that and of being the manager of the collection of insects at the University of Arizona. That's just as a little kid, did you think you were going to be the manager of an insect collecting place at the University of Arizona?
Well, like most biologists, I was interested in what I'm doing now early,
right.
and I got hooked on museum collections as a teenager, and as I said before, I eventually hoped towards the last part of my career, this is where I ended up back, because this is where I got trained and
right.
grew on about insects, and I feel like I've got the greatest job in the world, and I'm very happy to be here and look forward to it every day.
Well, we're glad you're here, and we're glad that you like bugs and that you like insects and that you are managing them. So thank you, Gene Hall, Collections Manager of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Arizona, and appreciate your being with us today. And if you hear those cicadas today, you know that Gene's got some that he's cataloged down at the university. Thanks for being on Jump In Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Welcome back to Jump In Tucson. I am Ed Ackerley. This is the Monday Wonder Series, where we talk about the good things that are happening at the University of Arizona, not only on campus with research and learning, but also what impact the University of Arizona has around the world, and maybe we can say around the solar system. So with us in this segment is Dr. Ashley Davies. He is with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the NASA over in Pasadena. If anybody knows anything about Pasadena, that's where the Rose Bowl Parade is. That's where the house and Father of the Bride is located in Pasadena. But what's really important about Pasadena is the JPL Laboratory. And welcome aboard, Dr. Ashley Davies. Welcome.
Good morning, Ed. Happy to be here.
So when did you become interested in becoming an astronomer? Was this when you were a little kid? Did you think about the stars and becoming working in the universe of that? Or how'd you get interested?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I was always interested in astronomy. When I was a little boy growing up in the UK, in London, Apollo was in full swing. And I can remember one of my fondest childhood memories is getting up very early on the morning of, it was back in the UK, it would have been the 21st of July, 1969, right. Watching Neil Armstrong take his giant leap for mankind. On television.
I'm with you. My family was glued to the television over here in Tucson. And I remember
it made a huge impression on me.
Yeah, staying up all night and watching that and how powerful that was just even back then, which is now, goodness gracious, almost my lifetime away. Yeah. So where did you go to school, and what's your educational background as you became an academic and a scientist? What's your educational background?
Well, yes, it started off with a bachelor's degree in astronomy, geology, and physics at the University of Hertfordshire, and then a doctorate at the University of Lancaster in volcanology, which specializing in volcanism on Io, which I think
we're going to get to later. Right.
And then after a couple of years after that, I applied for a postdoctoral research associateship at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And I've never looked back. I've been at JPL for over 30 years now.
Wow.
It's been an absolutely astonishing career. And it's just getting better and better and more exciting.
So the University of Arizona is pretty famous for space and astronomy and work in that area, mirror labs and telescopes and all sorts of wonderful things. And I mentioned to you that Pam Scott, who's the Vice President of Communications, speaks to my classes, and one of the little tidbits of information that she shares is that the University of Arizona has participated in every major NASA program to outer space since the inception of NASA. The U of A has either, in many cases, like the Mars mission and so forth, they controlled the mission, and the Bennu, the recent going to OSIRIS-REx, they were the managers for that whole process. Of course, there's other scientists from around the world and other universities that are participating, but the U of A has a great connection. Have you had, obviously, you're at JPL, so U of A has many people over there that work from time to time, so you have a good collaboration with the University of Arizona in your JPL experience, right?
Absolutely, for decades. And I have existing research and analysis projects ongoing with friends and colleagues at the University of Arizona. And I mean, their contributions to planetary science, it's incalculable. It's just vast, absolutely vast.
Right.
But yes, a very good working relationship with colleagues there on missions past, present, and hopefully future.
Right. And, you know, obviously over the last couple of days, we've had, last week we had the Boeing mission go up to the space station, and The big giant rocket that the Elon Musk groups sent off to try and test that, and it came down in the Indian Ocean. So yeah. space is getting a focus again, and maybe that manned mission to the moon again to go back to the moon with human Mars. Beings, and then a Mars and then a Mars mission as well. Maybe go to Mars, maybe in our lifetime still. Maybe try to send a couple people to Mars. So. Space and astronomy is taking front and center again. 60 years after President Kennedy said we're going to send man to the moon and bring him back safely.
I think we're carrying on the president's legacy in this respect. JPL's purpose is the robotic exploration of the solar system. Although obviously there's a lot of crossover with the crewed space programs.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of exciting things happening at the moment. The next big thing is going to be the launch of the Europa Clipper mission, which will be going to the Jovian system. Mm-hmm. And of course, University of Arizona is heavily involved in that. A lot of personnel involved. A lot of people who came through University of Arizona and moved on to other institutions are involved in that.
Right.
That's going to be the next big NASA flagship mission launch, and that's scheduled for October. So fingers crossed everything goes well for that. That's going to be very exciting.
It's not to say that there was a lull, but there for a while it seemed like space and sending out craft and so forth was kind of, of course, NASA obviously is always fighting for congressional budget and so forth.
Sure.
And now these partnerships with some of these private companies and hitching a ride on some of these private rockets and so forth has kind of changed the dynamics of the way NASA is structured now. And Bill Nelson, who's the director, former senator who is in charge, makes no bones about the fact if we're going to continue, we got to be collaborative with other countries and we got to be yes. collaborative with private enterprise as well.
Yes. I mean, collaboration is, I think, the way ahead. It's an expensive business. And there's something to be said for pooling resources and also pooling the brains behind these things in order to maximize the return. So, I think collaborations with other agencies is crucial for future exploration.
Right.
The Europa Clipper mission that's going to Jupiter mm-hmm. is partnered with the European Space Agency's JUICE mission, which is already in flight. I mean, that launched last year. It's already on its way.
Right.
Both of these spacecraft will be exploring in detail different bodies in the Jupiter system, as well as Jupiter itself, in the early 2030s. It's just really exciting.
It's important that we have instruments out in space. The Hubble is going through a retweak, and just the telescopes that are out there. It's really important that they. I heard the statistic the other day that if we wanted to send a manned spacecraft to the closest galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy. It would take us 80,000 years to get there. And
absolutely, yeah. It's it's just something of the scale of operation. Right. Even getting to planets in our neighborhood can take months to years.
Yeah.
Getting to Jupiter, we're launching Clipper in October. It's not going to really start sending back data from Jupiter for another 5.5 years.
Wow.
So space is big.
Yeah.
It's vast. It takes a long time to traverse these huge distances.
Even Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 that have been out there for several decades are out in the middle of nowhere. And
right, JPL's finest.
Yeah, those are amazing. And they say those will go on for infinity. Unless someone picks the bottle out of the ocean and looks at it and says, "What's this bottle in the ocean?"
Yeah.
Those could go on
Where
forever.
Where did this come from?
Yeah, those could go on forever. And Carl Sagan's record are on both of those. So
yeah,
that
the
they
records
can,
are on there. So there's a map. There's a map to find.
But they're the first two man-made devices that have escaped our solar system and are out in the middle of space, right?
I think they're the first to escape the solar system that we're still in contact with.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And
I'm not entirely sure about that.
I think you are correct.
Some of the early pioneers might be out there somewhere.
Yeah, but I think that the ones we're still in contact with are the Voyagers.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, which is amazing. Well, we're talking here about space and astronomy and so forth with Dr. Ashley Davis from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory over in Pasadena, California. When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit about the volcanic world of Io, the moon on in Jupiter's orbit, and what the exciting new project that will take a few more years to come to fruition, but great to find out some more wonderful things about our solar system. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM The Voice. We'll be back right after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. With us is Dr. Ashley Davis. He's with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory with NASA over in Pasadena, California. And, of course, the University of Arizona is infamous for its work in astronomy and mapping the universe and mapping. We were just talking about how the U of A was helpful in mapping the backside of the moon, and the Chinese just launched a craft there and took some samples on the backside of the moon, and it's headed back to the Earth as we speak. So the U of A has had a lot of activity there. So our Monday series is the Wonder Series, where we talk about the wonderful things that are happening. Well, one of the neat things, you've been at JPL for, you say, about 30 years. So Dr. Davis, tell us a little bit about the volcanic world of Io and Jupiter's moon and what you hope to get with the spacecraft that's heading that way.
Yes, Io is just one of the wonders of the solar system. It's a body about the size of Earth's moon, but it just happens to be the most volcanically active body in the solar system. And my training and my interests are in volcanology and planetary science. So it's a great place to study volcanoes. It's this incredible volcanic world. And I think it's one of the keys to understanding the evolution of the Jovian system and the satellite system there. Because it's tidally heated, it's in a sort of a gravitational tug of war mm-hmm. with Jupiter and Europa and Ganymede, two of the other big moons of Jupiter. I think understanding just how Io ticks will really give us a lot of understanding into how the other satellites in the Jovian system evolved.
So when you talk about that, those tidal forces that are coming with the gravitational pull of the other moons and Jupiter itself, that's what creates the volcanism, right? So it's a little different than what's happening on Earth, where
right.
Where there's a molten core and around the core and then the molten sure. around it, and it's seeping through the cracks in the...
Yeah, and that's the fascinating thing. On Earth, all of the volcanism that we see is generated from within. Mm-hmm. The forces that create the molten rock that erupts at the surface are from heat trapped within the Earth and being generated by, for example, the decay of radioisotopes that were incorporated into the interior of the Earth when the Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago. But with Io, the force that's generating this internal heating is external, and that's why it's probably the best place, because things are so extreme on Io, the tidal heating is so extreme. This is a process that affects other bodies in the solar system, but Io is a great place to understand it. And in doing so, we actually gain insight in some of the things that helped form the early Earth. Mm-hmm. Seeing things on a scale on Io that once were prevalent on Earth and the Moon and on Mars, but along extinct.
So when we have a volcano, say on Kilauea in Hawaii or in Iceland or wherever, and that's bringing up magma from the molten rock that's coming up and then exploding and then creating islands and so forth. What is coming out sure. of Io? What's coming out of Io? What is?
We don't know exactly what's coming out of the volcanoes there, and that's one of the things that we'd really like to know. But it's probably very similar to what has erupted on Earth for much of Earth's history. Basalt, volcanic rock from that's most common on Earth, mid-ocean ridges, and as you mentioned, in Iceland and in Hawaii, is this relatively runny, high temperature lava, and it's possible that the lavas erupting on Io, at least in part, are actually higher temperature lavas generated from intense heating of the mantle. That's one of the things that we'd like to figure out. What the precise composition is, because that tells us a lot about the state of Io's interior, and that goes back into just how much tidal heating is taking place and where it's taking place.
Right.
So it's a great volcanic laboratory for understanding these sort of processes.
For the Jupiter system, do we know what is in the interior of Jupiter itself? Do we know if it's kind of a mix between rocky planet and gaseous, or is it? Do we know what's down in the middle of that huge planet? And
I think Jupiter is this sort of failed star. It's a lot of hydrogen, uh-huh. highly compressed down into something in the center, which is generating an awful lot of heat.
Right.
I don't
and has been
really
doing that for billions.
Center on it. Yeah.
It's been no doing that for billions of years, right? Yeah, generating
yeah,
that heat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's this incredible heat source.
Right.
And it's a huge, huge mass, and so matter undergoes some interesting changes when you subject it to these high temperatures and high pressures at the center.
And there might be dozens or more moons circulating around it, but it's the major moons that you talked about that are causing this volcanic reaction on
Sure.
Io.
Sure. There are four large moons of Jupiter and dozens. And quite frankly, I've lost count of how many have been found.
Right.
There are four large moons, three of which, Europa, Io, and Ganymede, are caught in this gravitational dance, if you like, this orbital resonance, which locks these three moons together and which generates this incredible amount of heating within Io and to a lesser extent within Europa and Ganymede. So this is one of the reasons why NASA and ESA are going to explore Callisto, Europa, Ganymede, to see if especially if Europa and Ganymede can provide environments that could be conducive to supporting life. So it's part of a more in-depth investigation that's been done before of these satellites.
Right. We're talking with Dr. Ashley Davies from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory with NASA in Pasadena, California, who works in collaboration with our scientists and astronomers from the University of Arizona. So would any of these moons of Jupiter, would any of them, like Titan from Saturn, are any of them slated as being, launch points for, hopping from our moon to Mars to on out the end of
I
the...
I think mankind expanding throughout the solar system over the next century or two, it's inevitable that eventually there'll be exploration of Mars,
right.
Exploration of the asteroids, maybe for resource mining.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean it's a long way to Jupiter. It'll be a long, hard trip.
5.5 years to get there, huh? Yeah.
It's kind of a hostile environment out there as well, in terms of the radiation generated by
right.
Jupiter. Who knows? One day, maybe crewed missions will go out to explore in person.
How long does it take to get once the aircraft, the spacecraft, are sending back their information?
Yeah.
How long does it take to get from, say, from Io back to the United States and to your lab? Is it
In terms of actual travel time,
yeah.
In terms
of they send a signal,
Oh, a signal.
Yeah.
A
long time.
I think it's in the order of okay. I can't remember exactly. Maybe 20 minutes.
Right.
I think
right.
A 20 minute time lag.
So
again,
it's just
distance divided by the speed of light, and it
yeah.
depends on
yeah.
which side of the sun
right.
or how far away.
Right.
How far away, yeah.
But it's
Io is from Earth.
But it's similar to looking at the if you go outside and the sun is shining, what
yeah.
you're seeing is energy
yes.
that left 8 minutes ago and got just
ago.
Got to
so,
you.
So
you
always 5 times that to Jupiter. Then
we're always looking. We're always looking back in time, aren't we? Because it's
always
it's,
looking back in time.
It's hard to look to the future. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Davis, for being with us and telling us about the exciting trip to Io. And the volcanism there. We appreciate you being on Jump in Tucson, the Wonder version, where we talk about the cool things that the University of Arizona is involved in. If you'd like to be on Jump in Tucson, go to jumpintucson.com, and maybe you can be interviewed on the air. So if you work at the U of A or you have an organization that needs to tell your story, let us know. This is Tucson's only live local news and talk station, KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Thank you, Dr. Davis. We appreciate you being here and telling us about your exciting things that you do at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And have a good week, and we'll hopefully talk to you again soon.
Ed, thank you very much indeed.
All right. This is Jump in Tucson on KVOI.